Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today. The pastoral epistles are letters to church leaders instructing them how churches should function. Though they are not well read by most Christians today, they remain authoritative for pastors, elders, and deacons in many churches. Today we'll cover 1 and 2 Timothy, Titus, and Philemon. We'll explore the major theme of how the church should be a well-run household where godliness prevails. Additionally, we'll consider qualifications for leadership, warnings against false teachers, and the incredible importance of sound teaching. Here now is episode 547, part 14 of our Read the Bible for Yourself class, How to Read the Pastoral Epistles.
As I've mentioned to you before, the New Testament has 27 books. 21 of those books are epistles. Last time we looked at the 9 church epistles. Next time we'll look at the 8 general epistles. But today we're just going to look at the 4 in the middle. 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, and Philemon. It's debatable, I'll just be real honest here, it's debatable if Philemon is a pastoral epistle. So I'm just going to let you know. But I think it fits in better here than anywhere else. So I'm just going to lump them in. Philemon was a church leader, and Paul is writing to give him specific advice on what to do, instruction. So I think it's similar enough we can lump it in, but it is different than the other three. So what we're going to do is I'm going to look at 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus all at the same time because they're all so similar. And then at the end, we'll look at Philemon. Philemon's incredibly short, about a page in your Bible. So that's not going to take us long to get through. As far as location goes, we know from 1 Timothy 1:3 that Timothy was in Ephesus and Titus was in Crete. Crete is an island in the Mediterranean. And basically, Timothy and Titus are people that Paul has trained for ministry, that he has mentored, and that are now, as Paul's representatives, giving instruction to other leaders in these other churches in Ephesus and Crete. So that gives you a little setup for what we're talking about here. Paul, at this point, when he's writing the pastoral epistles, is an old man. He's been beaten, persecuted, imprisoned, held in custody, transported across the entire Mediterranean Sea, shipwrecked halfway through, and then put on another ship and brought to Rome, where he's under house arrest. And, you know, there's some questions about, like, did he get out after that, or did he just go into a more serious imprisonment in Rome? And, you know, people discuss these things and they have theories. But then eventually he is nearing death when he's writing these epistles. And he is going to get executed by the Roman government. We know that he was executed. It's not written in the Bible, but it's written in other historical Christian documents that he was executed by the Roman government in the 60s sometime, is best guess. Maybe 64. We don't know exactly what year. But just to give you a perspective on that. When Paul writes the church epistles, he talks a lot about the body of Christ and how we are all members of the body of Christ, and we have diversity, but we also have unity along with that diversity. Everybody's not an eye or a foot or a hand, but we're all part of the same body. He also uses the metaphor of a family. Brothers, sisters. Why are we called brothers and sisters? Well, it's not because we're genetically related. It's because God is our Father. That's a metaphor that Paul uses in the epistles. He also uses the metaphor of a temple, that we are together, all the Christians together, are sort of like built into a worship structure to worship God. Now, in the pastoral epistles, the focus is different. These are not public documents to be read out loud to whole churches. These are private documents sent to Timothy and to Titus. Now, after years went by, they were collected and added to all of Paul's epistles and, you know, have been read publicly ever since. But I'm saying originally, it's not like Timothy would take this letter and then go read it out loud. It's personal instruction for Timothy. It's personal instruction for Titus. And as a result, the tone of the letter is different. You don't see all that rhetorical flourish of Paul making his case to argue. He knows Timothy's going to do whatever he tells him to do. He knows Titus is on board and is committed. He doesn't argue. He just gives them instruction. And you also don't have the sort of optimism of being a younger Paul. Younger Paul encountered the Galatians and he said, let's write a letter. I'm going to convince those guys. He encountered the super apostles in 2 Corinthians and argued, I mean, just a masterful rhetorical persuasion to win them back to his side. In 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus, it's just like, well, warn them a couple times, and if they don't listen to you, just move on. You know, you kind of get that sense of like, we're not making arguments anymore. We're just dealing with church leadership stuff. And so in the pastoral epistles, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus in particular, he likes to use the illustration of a household. He says in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 14, I am writing these instructions to you so that you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. Households in the Greco-Roman world were hierarchical, they were large, they were well-ordered. Everyone had a role and everyone knew their position, their place, their status. In a household, you had grandparents, you had parents, you had aunts, you had uncles, you had cousins, you had children, you had slaves, and then people that were freed from slavery but chose to stay in the household. It's called freedmen or freedwomen. The ZIBBC says, in Xenophon's essay, the husband instructs his 14-year-old bride, did you catch that? The average age for marriage among Greek and Roman girls was 14 to 16. Anyhow, in this essay, the husband instructs his 14-year-old bride on her vital role in managing the household resources, including the care and supervision of household slaves, while he supervised the gathering of produce from the farms. Because of the presence of slaves and freedmen in an average ancient household, management of sometimes large households could be demanding. I'm just going to say a word about slavery. In the Roman Empire, slavery had nothing to do with race. It had nothing to do with your looks. It had to do with the circumstances of your birth. It had to do with if you were in a village that the Romans conquered and you didn't get killed, guess what? You were enslaved. If you are a slave and you have children, those children are born into slavery. So there were black slaves, there were white slaves, there were slaves of many different ethnicities, and in many cases, people could earn their freedom by saving up, or in other cases, they were slaves for life. Some of the slaves had really good lives, like the guys that I mentioned last time that were in the imperial household. That's a good place to be a slave. But most houses are not Caesar's house, right? So not everyone's going to have that experience. But there were also what they call chattel slavery, slaves that are just working the fields, slaves that work the mines, even worse. Life expectancy is very short. There were a lot of prostitute slaves. So, you know, I don't want you to get the impression that slavery was just like la-di-da-di-da in the Roman Empire. Very different than American slavery, but still had its horror and in some cases some benefits as well. My point in mentioning that is that because there were slaves, it made the household sizes larger. And it's helpful for us to understand what a Greco-Roman household was like so we understand what Paul means when he says the church is like a household. It's God's household. So let me give you another quick quote. This is from The World of the New Testament. An author named Lynn Kohick writes, the family in the Greco-Roman world valued the community over the individual. We as Americans value the individual over the community. We have the opposite sensibility. Whereas most Africans would put the community over the individual and perhaps Asians as well. Okay, so she goes on, promoted corporate honor and fortune. Those living in the domus, the home, included parents and children and perhaps extended family, such as adult siblings, cousins, and grandparents, as well as slaves, freedmen, and freedwomen. Each individual had a specific status within the home, and each family member deemed the social status of the family, including its wealth and social prestige, as of equal or greater value than their personal happiness. So this ties in to what Paul is telling Timothy and Titus. He's saying to them, the church is a household of God. He wants each of the churches they're sent to and organizing and giving advice to the leaders of these churches, he wants these churches to be well-ordered, to be well-managed, not to be chaotic in the leadership. People need to know their roles. What are you supposed to do? What status are you? What role are you? This kind of thing. He's concerned about what outsiders think. That's what the last sentence I just read to you. They care more about the family prestige than their personal happiness. That's the world Paul's writing within. I think there is some individualism in the New Testament too, just for the record. I don't think they're all communists or something. But there is definitely a much greater value of the community over the individual than we have in our culture in the United States. It says in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 7, moreover, he, the overseer, must be well thought of by outsiders so that he may not fall into disgrace and the snare of the devil. He wants church leaders, that's what an overseer is, a church leader, to have a good reputation in the world, not just in the church. It's important to show that Christianity works. If the Christian communities are full of factions and strife, what is that testifying to the world that's watching? In households, everyone has a place and a role. So it is in the household of God. And so we see this spelled out in Timothy and Titus. They talk about the men's role, including older men, younger men, the woman's role, including older women, younger women. They talk about respecting your elders. They talk about how young widows should marry. They talk about taking care of your own family. If your father dies, it's your job to take care of your mother. If you're a Christian, that makes sense. Previously, that the Jewish people had the same mindset, honor your father and your mother. But then there would be some widows that, for whatever reason, their family isn't taking care of them. And it says to support real widows, as opposed to widows that, you know, had other people taking care of them or had other opportunities. He tells slaves to obey and submit. This is very hard for us to hear as Americans. We don't like this. Slavery was a universal institution in the ancient world. What I mean by universal is every of the different civilizations around in the first century, not just the Romans, but everybody has slaves. So this is not answering the question, is slavery good? No. We know Paul doesn't think slavery is good. He talks about it briefly in 1 Corinthians, maybe it was chapter 7. He says, look, if you can get free from slavery, just get free. And don't get enslaved. So he's not like pro-slavery, but it is a reality. And he knows there are some Christians who are slaves. And those Christians want to know, how do I be a Christian in this situation that I can't change? And so he gives instruction within that context. Now, subsequent Christians have used this in America to tell slaves they have to obey their masters in a very twisted way that this is not originally addressing, okay? So I think it is uniquely a difficult one. Anyhow, he also tells the rich to be humble and generous. Basically, the idea of this household is that if everyone does their duty, the household runs well, and it's a testimony to those outside the church that Christianity is good, and you shouldn't kill us. That's the concern. Christians would be killed by the Roman government if the Roman government looked at the churches and saw them as subversive or revolutionary. That they were trying to undermine the government in some way. Hey, we don't really need to pay our taxes. Jesus said we don't have to. That's subversion, right? The government's going to come down on that like a hammer. Or if they're saying, you know what, let's just revolt. Let's just grab our weapons and just go kill the governors. That's the context of the pastoral epistles. Like, how do we establish these churches in a way that's going to reflect well upon us as Christians, especially to a watching Roman world? And in the context of that, there's one word that comes up a lot, and it's mentioned here in 1 Timothy 4, verses 7 and 8. It says, have nothing to do with profane and foolish tales. Train yourself in godliness. Train yourself in godliness. For while physical training is of some value, godliness is valuable in every way, holding promise for both the present life and the life to come. The word for godliness, we typically say it in English, Eusebia or Eusebia. There's a famous Christian historian named Eusebius. If you ever heard of him, maybe you haven't. I can't resist making that connection because he's very important for church history. But Eusebia or Eusebia is translated godliness, but it has nothing to do with being like God or imitating God. If I say to you, be godly, you probably think, be like God. But that's not what this word means. The word God is not in this word anywhere. It's a compound word. The first part of it, that EU there, means good. And then this is talking about your being devout or your worship or reverence. So consider these definitions. It's showing expected reverence, equivalent to the Latin pietas, which is where we get the word piety. So a Eusebian person is a person who is pious, reverent, dutiful. It's shown not just to God or gods, but also to the city and to one's own household. It's the idea of being a dutiful person who shows proper honor and is appropriate in that particular situation. It's not a word that occurs everywhere in the New Testament. It's distinctive to the pastoral epistles. It's a major concern here. It occurs 22 times in the New Testament. There's 27 books in the New Testament. This word only occurs 22 times. So it's not a big word. It doesn't occur hundreds of times or thousands of times. But 13 of those usages are in 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. So 60% almost of the usages of this particular word family is found in the pastoral epistles, which tells me it's a major concentration. And so this is an example of how to read the pastoral epistles. Find words that are being emphasized and repeated, and it's not exactly the same word. In one case, it's godly, in another place, it's godliness. Make the connection anyhow, okay? Don't be so strict. These are the same idea. One's just an adverb and one's a noun, and then there's an adjective as well. So it says in Titus chapter 2, verse 11, for the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all, training us to renounce impiety, that's the opposite of godliness, and worldly passions in the present age, to live lives that are self-controlled, upright, and godly. So we have this ungodly word paired with worldly passions. So what does he not want the churches to be? Just impulsive and just enslaved to their desires, their bodily desires, these worldly passions. Instead, he wants them to be self-controlled, upright, and godly. And by godly, we mean carrying yourself respectfully. So anyhow, I just figured I would mention that because it's not obvious. Here's another usage. I don't have it on the screen, but I'll just read it to you. It's 1 Timothy 5:4. It says, if a widow has children or grandchildren, they should first learn their godly duty to their own family. What does it mean there? It means taking care of somebody that is in need. Right? So it's not even to do with worship. It's just the proper response to the situation you're in. Which this translation translates it as your religious duty. But it's just the word godliness. So it's interesting. To be godly to your elderly mother or grandmother is to take care of her financially. Paul wants the Christian community to be seen as respectful and dignified. Why? Because otherwise they're going to kill us. Okay? Does it make sense? You want to come off putting your best foot. This makes perfect sense once you think of the context they're in. He's literally in prison for being a Christian. He's going to be executed by the government. That's what we're dealing with. Now let's give some advice to the churches. So it helps you to have that in mind. Let's talk about leadership. There are a lot of qualifications listed in 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus for overseers, elders, and deacons. They don't tend to use the word pastor, but I think that's the idea of an overseer, somebody that looks over the sheep or the flock. Deacon is somebody that is serving within the church, but is somebody usually that would be taking care of those who are poor or those who are in need of food. And we learn more about early Christian government from later documents after the New Testament than we do here. In the New Testament, what we learn is the qualifications. What would qualify you? What would disqualify you? And guess what the number one qualification is? 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 4. For an overseer, he must manage his own household well, keeping his children submissive and respectful in every way. And if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how can he take care of God's church? You see how household is central to the thinking of church leadership? If you're a bad manager in your own regular life, why would you manage the affairs of a congregation or of a community? Now, many churches around the world take these qualifications, and I didn't list them all out for you here, but I think I probably gave them to you in your notes. Many churches around the world take these literally and use them in modern times, including our church, just so you know. There are other churches that say we don't really need to follow the qualifications of what it says, and we can just do something different. But that's not the kind of church that we are. We're a Bible church, so we're going to stick with what the Bible says. Okay, warnings against false teachers. This is a major leadership problem, and it's always around. I don't care what century you're talking about, if you're in the Middle Ages, or if you're in early Greco-Roman period, or if you're living today, there are always false teachers, there are always false teachings. What were the problems that he was dealing with? Well, there were some strange Jewish teachings that were talking about these myths and endless genealogies and meaningless talk. And he warns Timothy in particular about these teachings. He says, don't get into this stuff with these guys. It's a false teaching. And then he talks about asceticism. Asceticism is denying yourself bodily pleasure, which typically relates to eating and sex. Doesn't have to just be those two things, but somehow or other, the conversation always ends up going back to those two. And so there's people teaching that you shouldn't eat good food. You should just eat, you know, very simple food or food that was less desirable because eating good food gives you pleasure and pleasure is sinful. Paul comes against that. He says, no, that's not Christianity, bud. You know, that's not where we're coming from. Some people are even forbidding marriage, saying you shouldn't get married if you're a Christian. And so he comes against that too. And he tells Timothy to, hey, nip this false teaching in the bud. He talks about proto-Gnostics. That's the whole topic by itself. Gnostics are a Christian sect, if we can call them Christian, that had an elaborate system of beliefs that reinterpreted the Bible. And it was a real threat to Christianity in the second century. Paul's writing in the first century, and so these are what we call proto-Gnostics, like the intellectual ancestors of the Gnostics that were already starting to say similar things that would eventually develop into what we call Gnosticism. And so Paul warns them about that. He warns about wrangling over words, profane chatter. He says at one point, have nothing to do with stupid and senseless controversies. You hear the old man Paul here? It's like, just stay away from all that nonsense. Just focus on serving God. And then he also encourages them to correct opponents with gentleness. So even though he might come across as like a little stricter or whatever in the pastorals, I think you have to recognize he's talking to his guys that know him, that trust him, that are committed to him. If he was actually interacting with one of these false teachers, he says do it with gentleness. So I think that's an important lesson. And then he names individuals. He names Hymenaeus, Alexander, Phygellus, Hermogenes, Philetus, and then Alexander the coppersmith. I don't know if it's the same Alexander or different Alexander. This is unprecedented. You don't see Paul doing this in the church epistles. Even when there was a guy in Corinth sleeping with his father's wife, he doesn't name the guy. But in the pastorals, he's naming names. Why? These are not public letters. These are private letters to Timothy and Titus. He trusts them, and they need to know who these people are because he's hearing stuff about them, and it's just a different context, so it makes sense. On to the next aspect of the pastorals, sound teaching. This is a phrase that occurs a lot in the pastoral epistles, sound teaching. The actual Greek phrase could also be translated healthy doctrine. So the idea is that sin is when you live contrary to healthy doctrine. In our world, we don't like that. In our world, we say, no, your beliefs don't really matter. Just what matters is how you treat people. That's not their world. And it's also not true. Because your belief always affects your behavior. So he talks a lot about sound teaching or healthy doctrine. And he encourages Timothy and Titus over and over again. Just make sure you have sound teaching. Rebuke those who are not sound in the faith. Some people won't put up with sound teaching. Hold to the standard of sound teaching. You know, he uses these phrases a lot, so I figured I'd mention it. You know, as you're reading through, you circle them. You just notice them. And, you know, it kind of helps you stay engaged with your mind while you're reading through the pastoral epistles. And then there's also a lot of encouragement, tons of encouragement. He calls Timothy his true child in the faith. He calls him his beloved child. He says to Timothy, fight the good fight. I love that line. He says to Timothy, let no one despise your youth. He says to Titus, also, you're my true child in the faith. And I don't think each one had the other's letter necessarily. So you could have multiple true child in the faith, I'm sure. And he also says to Titus, let no one look down on you. So he's encouraging these guys to like really be able to do the work that needs to be done. There's also significant theology in the pastoral epistles. Not a lot, but there's a few real nuggets of theology that are really helpful if you're looking at doctrine. When reading the pastoral epistles, I don't know if I said this clearly enough, so I'm going to say it again. It's mostly focused on church leadership. If you said to me, Sean, I don't have time to read everything, what do you want me to focus on in the epistles? I would say, well, don't worry about the pastoral epistles unless you're in church leadership, because that's what the focus is. Now, having said that, church leaders need to read the pastoral epistles and read them enough so that they don't forget what they say, because that's the standard we're being held to, not whatever the world says is okay. And that's changing all the time. The pastorals tell us who is qualified and who is disqualified for church leadership, and it is good for everyone to know. I don't think it's like forbidden from you to read. I'm just saying it's not like a high priority unless you're dealing with the church leadership issue. It's good for everyone to know what they say so you can hold your leaders accountable. On to Philemon. I feel like I've been talking about slavery nonstop. Philemon was a Christian. He was a wealthy person. He owned his own house. And he had a household, including slaves. One of those slaves was a man named Onesimus. And we do not know what happened. But for whatever reason, Onesimus ran away from Philemon. And then somehow or other, and Paul doesn't explain this. Like I said, Philemon is literally one page, okay? So like he doesn't explain this. He says that he met Onesimus while he was incarcerated, when Paul was incarcerated. We don't know if Onesimus was incarcerated with him or if he was just in the household serving and Paul met him that way, in the prison serving or wherever he, if he was under house arrest, whatever. We don't know the circumstances. Somehow they met. Onesimus becomes a Christian and he greatly helps Paul. And now Paul says to Onesimus, I want you to go back to your master and I want you to carry him this letter, the letter of Philemon. And it is a masterful piece of rhetoric. Rhetoric, as I mentioned before, is the art of persuasion. And Paul is a master at it. He really knows how to do it. Like, by their standards of the day, they'd be like, man, you got skills. You know, like, they have moves, and he's making those moves, right? And so he writes to Philemon, and he says to Philemon, I want you to accept Onesimus. He was useless to you, but he was useful to me. Onesimus' name means useful. It's a pun. He's playing on the words. He's just grabbing his attention. It's like, see, he's not useless. He's useful. And then he says, accept him as a brother. And if he owes you anything, put it on my account. And not to mention that you owe me your life. So, you know, we don't need to mention that. Of course, he mentions it, that he doesn't need to mention it. This is, according to Ben Witherington III, the Emancipation Proclamation of the New Testament. This is where Paul is doing something that is just incredible. He's saying, treat him like, to us this just doesn't sound radical. You don't say to a household master to treat a runaway slave like a brother. That's called equality. And so it's a very powerful, I mean, it's a short document, but it's a powerful document. And Paul then says, he ends the epistle by saying, and prepare a room for me because I'm going to come check up on you. Which is probably not going to happen unless he gets out of prison, right? But, you know, there is a kind of like a sense of a threat there. Actually, I can read it on this little slide. It says, and one more thing, prepare a guest room for me because I hope to be restored to you in answer to your prayers. It's just a masterful little document. I recommend it to you. Let's review. Paul wrote the pastoral epistles toward the end of his life. The metaphor of a household illustrates how the churches should function. Everyone should play their role according to their duty, whether men or women or elderly or young. Godliness is a major concept in the pastoral epistles. It refers to performing your duty with proper honor. It's important that Christians live respectfully and with proper dignity before a watching and suspicious world. The pastoral epistles include clear qualifications for church leaders, including that they manage their own households well. The churches in Ephesus and Crete were beset with false teachers from both Jewish and Greco-Roman sources. Paul encourages Timothy and Titus to adhere to sound teaching, healthy doctrine, so that people will escape the dangers of false teachers. Philemon was a wealthy church leader who managed a household that included slaves. Paul sent Philemon, his runaway slave, instructing him to accept Onesimus as a brother. Well, that's enough for the pastoral epistles. Next time, we'll consider the last section of the epistles, which I'm calling the general epistles. They're also called the Catholic epistles, but they're the last eight in the list of 21 as we continue in our class to read the Bible for yourself.
Well, that brings this session to an end. What did you think? Come on over to Restitutio.org and find episode 547, How to Read the Pastoral Epistles, and leave your feedback there. So today we're in part 14 of an 18-part class on how to read the Bible. But did you know that Restitutio has 13 other classes available for free right now? These are all on the website, Restitutio.org. Let's see. Nine of them, I believe I was the sole teacher for, and then we have one class where I was on a team of teachers with a number of others, including Dr. Marianne Yukonis, Russell and Joelle Brown, and my lovely wife, Ruth. And that's a parenting seminar that we have available on Restitutio. That's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. Also, we've got an evangelism seminar by Joshua Anderson. We've got Scripture and Science with Will Barlow. We've got a Son of David seminar by the inimitable Pastor Victor Gluckin of Rhode Island. And then a whole bunch of others just by me. Probably the one that has received the most downloads is probably a three-way tie between Early Church History, One God Overall, and How We Got the Bible. All three of those have done very well. But I also have a 24-part theology class that a lot of people have given me feedback on, a class on the kingdom of God, a whole class on apologetics. And really the first class I have on there is the historical Jesus, looking at the life of Christ from the Gospels. Now, these are all available in the podcast feed. If you're using a podcast app to listen to this, you can just scroll down. But also, I have a separate podcast with just the classes on it and no interruptions from interviews or sermons or other kinds of content. So if you are a podcast user and you're listening to this on your phone or your tablet using a podcast app, just subscribe to the Restitutio classes feed and then you can just cruise right through all those class sessions without being interrupted by other kinds of content, or just scroll down in the main feed to find these classes. A lot of podcast apps will allow you to reverse the order. So rather than going newest to oldest, you can go from oldest to newest, and then that might help make it easier to get through. These are also available on my YouTube channel as audio files, and some of them have video playlists on YouTube. Not all my classes are video recorded. Some of them are just audio. But to make it easy for you, you can just come over to restitutio.org, go to the menu My Classes, and you'll get links to everything that's available. So if there is a video, it will be linked there on that page. I also have links directly to Spotify and directly to Apple Podcasts, so that whatever you're using, you will be able to access episode one of each of the classes very easily. So take a look at the classes and see what else is out there. See what else you might be interested in. Well, friends, I'm currently out of town visiting Turkey and Greece on a Footsteps of Paul tour with Jerry Weirwool. And this is something that I have done in the past a couple of times, have traveled to Greece and Turkey and Israel. And yet I haven't seen everything that I need to see to really understand, especially the book of Acts, and to really appreciate the various cities. So I am very happy to be filling in a number of the cities that I have never been to yet, and also revisiting a couple of cities that I have been to before. And I just so believe in traveling to the Bible lands. I think everyone should do it. I really wish that in Christianity we had a culture of pilgrimage. Travel is so great because it helps you to, as I've been saying in this class, it helps you to see the sky, to see the stones, to see the ocean, to see what kinds of plants and trees grow in that place, to feel the air, and to meet the people. And a lot of times there are structures remaining. There are ruins that are very helpful. So I highly recommend to all of you to do this. I'll have to let you know how this trip goes when I get back, and I look forward to sharing a little bit about it. But anyhow, I figured I'd mention I am out of the country and taking lots of pictures and videos so that I can use this material in teachings and classes and sermons for the foreseeable future. That's going to be it for today. Thanks everybody for tuning in. If you'd like to support Restitutio, you can do that at our website, restitutio.org. There's a donate button there that you can use. If you are interested in a one-time gift or a monthly recurring gift, Restitutio is a tax-deductible, registered, legitimate nonprofit in the state of New York, registered with the United States government. And we do send out a summary for tax purposes in January of each year to aid people in doing their taxes for the tax deductible benefits of that. So yes, thanks to everyone who's doing that. So appreciate it. We'll see you next week. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.